Today is Wednesday, July 25th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Republicans are speaking out against a White House plan to offer a multi-billion dollar bailout to farmers hurt over tariff retaliation.
I've made it pretty clear I don't think tariffs are the right answer. I don't support tariffs. I think tariffs are taxes.
Is North Korea starting to dismantle its weapons sites? Wildfires in Greece claim dozens of lives. Also ahead, an American pop star hospitalized following a drug overdose. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump has said he will propose to European officials on Wednesday that both sides drop all tariffs, barriers, and subsidies. On Tuesday, the administration announced that American farmers will receive up to $12 billion in emergency relief as compensation for expected financial losses caused by the administration's trade policies.
Making tremendous progress. They're all coming. They don't want to have those tariffs put on them. They're all coming to see us. And the farmers will be the biggest beneficiary.
Direct assistance announced Tuesday by the Department of Agriculture comes amid tariffs imposed by the Trump administration on and retaliatory measures of other countries that are expected to cost U.S. food producers billions of dollars. Agriculture Undersecretary Greg Ibach explained the reasoning in a teleconference.
What this will do is provide some hope to farmers and ranchers that there is the president and the secretary do have their back.
But congressional Republicans, including House Speaker Paul Ryan, are expressing deep skepticism, saying farmers want free trade, not handouts.
I just don't think the tariff route is the smart way to go. I understand the president's plan. I understand what he's trying to do. And the goal he's trying to achieve is a good one, a better deal for Americans, better trade agreements. I just don't think tariffs are the way to go. And our members are making that pretty clear.
Senators say the aid package could help short term, but they're worried about losing long term access to export markets. Trump is meeting Wednesday with European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker. The U.S. and European allies have been at odds over the president's tariffs on steel and aluminum imports and are meeting as the trade dispute threatens to spread to automobile production. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. No welcome mat for President Putin from U.S. Congress. President Trump claims Russia will support Democrats in the U.S. congressional elections. Ink and Needles, New York, holds its annual tattoo expo. And hundreds of children still separated from parents at the U.S. border. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A wildfire raging east of Athens, Greece, has killed dozens of people and injured more than 100, including 16 children. Reuters reporter Grace Lee has more.
The small community of Mati was the worst hit, a popular tourist destination east of the capital. Greece is begging residents to abandon their homes and head to safe havens near the beach. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras cut short a trip to Bosnia on Monday and was seen rushing to an emergency meeting on the blaze. The country has also asked for help from its European Union partners. Authorities say at least 100 homes have been burned, as well as more than 200 vehicles. On Monday, a thick plume of smoke could be seen blanketing the Acropolis as the blaze continued to rage on.
That's Reporter's reporter Grace Lee. President Donald Trump Tuesday praised recent satellite images showing North Korea beginning the dismantling of key facilities at the Soha satellite launching station on the country's northwest coast.
New images just today show that North Korea has begun the process of dismantling a key missile site, and we appreciate that. We had a fantastic meeting with Chairman Kim, and it seems to be going very well.
U.S.-based North Korea Monitoring Group 38 North first reported that satellite images show the dismantling of a site that's part of development for ballistic missiles and space launch vehicles. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, speaking in California while meeting with Australia's foreign secretary, seemed to echo the president's sentiment.
So we've seen the open press reporting about the missile engine test site. It'd be entirely consistent with the commitment that Chairman Kim made to President Trump when the two of them were in Singapore together made that commitment to them orally. We've been pressing for there to be inspectors on the ground when that engine test facility is dismantled, consistent with Chairman Kim's commitment.
Well, a day after President Trump's summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, Trump tweeted that the North no longer is a nuclear threat, but their agreement contained no details about when or how North Korea would abandon its nuclear weapons program or shut down its existing nuclear facilities. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Joshua Pollack, senior research associate with the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, how reliable the report is.
Well, the pictures show what the pictures show. And what we can see in the pictures is that the North Koreans seem to be partway done taking apart their largest static rocket engine test stand. This is where they tested the engines for their new generation of missiles, including their ICBMs. And they have said in a foreign ministry spokesman statement earlier this month that they pledge to do this as a step towards denuclearization, and specifically as a way of verifying that they have ceased the production of ICBMs. Now, that is not strictly true, since you could make more engines without sending any to the test stand. But clearly there are reasons to want to have a test stand, whether it's for quality control, where maybe you would take every 10th engine built and use it there just to make sure that they're up to snuff, or if you wanted to make improvements to the design or to develop a new type of engine, you would want a test stand like this. So taking this apart is a useful step, and it effectively parallels what they did at their nuclear test site, where they demolished the entrances to the test tunnels.
Will the allowance of inspectors take place, in your view?
Well, Secretary Pompeo in his remarks said that we're pressing for this. I don't suspect that they will agree to that, and I'm not sure it matters. We can see the test stand quite clearly from space. It's an outdoor structure. We can see that most of the metal superstructure is gone now, and now the concrete part underneath still remains. These structures are visible from space, and I'm not quite sure what the value of having inspectors on the ground would be in this instance. Maybe it's to set a precedent. The secretary didn't explain that. He made it sound as if this was a demand that the United States continues to push. It's also not clear what the North Koreans might expect in exchange for this step, or whether they see it as a concession made in exchange for something the United States has already done. In the North Korean statement back in early July, I believe it was July 7th, they indicated that they saw everything they're doing as part of simultaneous actions that both sides would undertake, but they didn't describe what exactly they're expecting from the United States on this.
The issue of the return of remains of American servicemen killed in the Korean conflict, perhaps thousands held by North Korea, is a big issue. President Trump mentioned it to a veterans organization on Tuesday. Mr. Pompeo also, in his remarks after meeting with his Australian counterpart. Is there a sense that, as Bill Richardson, the former U.S. diplomat, indicated, that the North is dragging its feet, perhaps using these remains as a bargaining chip?
I think there's some merit to that. This goes back to this entire question of sequencing, where the North Koreans want to make progress, see progress on all fronts agreed at Singapore. And those fronts were improving relations, securing a peace regime, which is the term of art for a peace agreement in Korea, and denuclearization and return of remains. So from their point of view, by insisting on handing over all the remains that they have on site, that they have on hand, and arranging for new joint searches in the countryside, the North Koreans may think the Americans are trying to eat dessert first. This dispute on sequencing of how to implement the Singapore agreement is at the heart of the differences between the two countries right now. We also see the South Koreans pushing for exemptions to sanctions in order to implement their summit agreement, which has some economic dimensions. It's not clear how that will be received.
That's Joshua Pollack, Senior Research Associate with the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. The Israeli military says it shot down a Syrian warplane Tuesday after it entered Israeli airspace, but Syrian state media reports the warplane was fired on as it participated in operations against rebels in Syrian territory. Earlier this week, the Syrian government condemned the Israeli evacuation of White Helmet rescue workers from southern Syria. Ofer Zalzberg is the International Crisis Group's senior analyst for Israel. Speaking from Jerusalem, he tells International Edition's Sarah Williams what's known about the downing of this Syrian plane.
There is currently a campaign of the Syrian army with the Russian support to retake the southwest of Syria, immediately next to the Israeli-Syrian fence, and specifically that in the area that is being ruled by a group called Jesh Halet, which is affiliated with Islamic State, there is an aerial campaign there, Syrian airplanes, mostly some Russian ones. It seems like this Sukhoi, at least Russian made, are involved in bombarding the area before retaking it. And these airplanes are operating just next to the occupied Golan Heights, an area that is ruled by Israel and controlled aerially by Israel. And it seems that this Syrian airplane crossed the line, the armistice line, and Israel's Patriot missile took it down.
Has there been any response from Syria following this?
I've seen rhetorical responses, condemnations of this shooting down, but I haven't seen so far more than that.
What is the situation currently like in the southwest of Syria?
There is what is called a de-escalation zone since last July, created in an agreement with three guarantors, Russia, the U.S., and Jordan. And this is one of four de-escalation zones. And what we are seeing now is that the Syrian government is retaking them one by one. It already has retaken the eastern part of this de-escalation zone 2 weeks ago, and now is the part of Deraa city, and now is doing the same in the western one. The situation, therefore, is one of fighting and recuperating from this fighting. The dust slowly settles in. The preference of Damascus and Moscow was for the retaking to occur through reconciliation, they call it. The opposition usually refers to these as a surrender deal, deals in which the opposition accepts the rule of Damascus. It's the return of the Syrian government to providing everything in these areas, all kinds of services and military control. And then some degree of integration of the rebels back into the state, local authorities and things of the sort. But the group of Jesh Halet, the Islamic State's affiliated group, is not part of this preference because it is affiliated with Islamic State, is a terrorist organization. And their Syrian-Russian preference was indeed to eliminate them, in fact, militarily. And what we have seen with this airplane was a spillover incident of that fighting.
Over the last weekend, Israel evacuated hundreds of volunteer White Helmet rescue workers.
Yeah.
Now, apparently there were some, I guess there was some dispute over how many. I think originally they said there were 800 rescued. Then I heard later it was more like around 400, and then there were others still there. What is the latest on that?
So basically, these White Helmets are have operated only in rebel-held areas, and at least according to Russia and the Syrian government, they were backed by Western intelligence agencies. Certainly, we see now that Western governments are keen on rescuing them from the fighting. They have been characterized by Damascus, by Moscow, as affiliated with Jabhat al-Nusra, one of the two most hawkish organizations in Syria. And basically, there was an arrangement for 800 of them to be rescued, to be allowed exit, and then Israel to facilitate their passing through Jordan to Western states. Only some 400 of them were able to do this, and then the rest was disrupted, and the reason for that is not fully clear. This is the reason for the gap in the numbers. And it seems that among the 800 were not only White Helmets, but probably also some of the rebel leaders that the Western governments have supported in the past and feared that Assad will not integrate into the government but will torture and execute. And we are now waiting to see whether there will be a way still to allow for the remaining few hundred of this force to exit, if it's not through with Israel's help, then directly through Jordan, or whether they are trapped there and will need to fight with the Syrian army.
That's Ofer Zalzberg, International Crisis Group Senior Analyst for Israel. The cable news network, or CNN, is reporting that the White House will no longer publish public summaries of President Trump's calls with world leaders, a big shift from a common practice held by former Democratic and Republican administrations. VOA's chief White House correspondent Steve Herman tweeted that, quote, as tardy and scant as they may be, not issuing them at all would yield to foreign governments such as China and Russia control of the narrative. Joining us now to discuss is Robert Deitz, professor at George Mason University and former special counsel of the National Security Agency. Thank you for being with us. So how big of a deal do you think this is?
I think it's a big deal. These summaries have, I think, two really important roles. One is they announce to the American people what's happening. And, you know, transparency, it's kind of become the watchword of the day. But transparency in a democracy does matter. So that's kind of the first important part of these summaries. The second part is it allows the U.S. government to have a role in identifying what actually happened in these conversations. And for example, if President Trump speaks with President Putin and doesn't provide a summary of the conversation, then President Putin owns the narrative. And I think that's bad.
Is this something that's been done before from previous administrations, or is this something new?
You'd have to check with a historian, but to the best of my knowledge, this is new. And I have a sort of a guess, but I have an idea about what's lurking here.
What do you think it is?
If you recall, the idea has been floated that various former retired intel types are going to have their security clearances revoked. And this, I think, is designed as punishment because it will certainly have no practical effect. In the past, and I've sat in on some of these, the current director of the CIA, for example, will invite all his predecessors who are still alive to a luncheon, and he'll give, what's called in the biz a tour d'horizon, you know, what's going on in the world. And they will sit there attentively. They will sometimes ask questions. Occasionally, they will make suggestions about what should be done. But it's very useful because if something really bad happens, this is a lot of collective memory. And for example, General Hayden, Director Brennan, and DNI Director Clapper collectively have over 100 years of experience in the intel world. And so it is useful if something unprecedented happens or something that is quite new happens, the current director of the CIA can call these guys and say, hey, we're having this problem. Have you seen something like this? And I know General Hayden on occasion would call one of his predecessors and, you know, just chat about an issue. And that's very, very useful. The idea, I think, was to punish these folks, as I've read the newspaper articles, was to punish these folks for having made negative comments about Trump. All that stuff is based on open source material, stuff that's in the newspaper, stuff that's on radio and television. That's all open source stuff. That's not going to stop the criticism. I can't help thinking that this announcement is designed to be further punishment of the press. That is, you punish the sources of the press, people like Brennan, Hayden, and so forth. And in this latter case, you punish the press by not putting out a summary. I think it's crazy.
Could it also have something to do with the fact that we still don't really know what happened behind closed doors with President Trump and Vladimir Putin, Russia's president, and we may never know? And, you know, obviously he sees the trouble that he got from his outward press conference standing beside Russia's leader. So could this also be another way to keep people from having the ability to criticize what they don't know about?
Yes. And, you know, I think you're dead right. If you don't know what happens in a meeting between international leaders, you don't know what they're talked about. If there is no summary, then one can be actually think sort of the worst about what was communicated.
It would also leave our knowledge up to the foreign leaders' assessment of what the conversation looked like, in which case we really have no way to verify that.
Well, that's absolutely right. I was looking at the summary that the U.S. put out about Mr. Trump's conversation with Prime Minister Trudeau, and then the Canadian version. And, you know, it wasn't night and day exactly, but they were substantially different. And so you could imagine a situation, and that's Canada. You could imagine a situation with a country like Russia in which the narratives would be wildly different. And I can't see how that helps Mr. Trump, actually. As you recall, he got plenty of grief for his performance in Helsinki. And if he has a conversation with President Putin in which no summary is given and Mr. Putin puts out his narrative, it'd be a strong reaction, I think. You know, we are the country that owns the First Amendment. Russia doesn't.
And of course, the First Amendment, for those who don't know, would be freedom of speech. That's Robert Deitz, professor at George Mason University and former counsel of the National Security Agency. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Drug addiction is still a reality and becoming a bigger challenge in South Africa. A new way to share illicit drugs has made it even more complicated. From Johannesburg, Thuso Khumalo looks at the work of those who've taken it upon themselves to fight drug abuse.
32-year-old Sibusiso Vilakazi is a former drug addict living in Johannesburg. For the past 2 years, he has lived a clean life. He says he decided to quit doing drugs and pursue photography after seeing his life was falling apart. Now he's back to the streets, not for more drugs, but to persuade those still hooked to quit as well. He counsels them, buys them a little food, and urges them to go to rehabilitation centers. When they are sick, he urges them to go to the clinic.
They know about the dangers. They know what the drugs are doing to them. But then some of them, they're like, there's no need for me to stop because I'll go back to reality, go back to my problems and stuff. So they think that by taking drugs, it's eliminating their problems.
His biggest worry is the latest method of taking these drugs, popularly known as Bluetooth. This is a method where an addict injects a drug into their bloodstream and other addicts draw out his blood and injects it into their own bloodstream. With Nyaope, a concoction of dacha, heroin, antiretroviral drugs, red poison and acid being the most popular drugs amongst the youngsters, Vilegas says he fears that if they survive the fatal effects of the drug's ingredients, they are likely to contract HIV and other blood-transmitted diseases such as hepatitis. His message is slowly finding acceptance to his friends. Walked by a friend into drugs, 23-year-old Sienna Knighton says he now spends each day searching for money to feed his addiction. He is grateful people like Vilakazi have encouraged him to find other means of making a living instead of stealing. And Knighton says the will to quit drugs is gradually overwhelming him.
It is a dream for me to change right now because my life is terrible because I can't do another thing, you know. I'm always running after my addictions.
He is already warning those not hooked never to try drugs, especially the youth.
Stay away from the drugs, don't try the drugs, and don't even wanna look at them.
Law enforcement officials in Johannesburg are also pursuing drug peddlers with the hope of stemming out the drug supply. Wayne Minar, spokesperson of the Johannesburg Metro Police Department, has ordered his corps to sweep the streets clean from drugs.
We want to get our city to be beautiful. All the bylaws must be obeyed.
Martin Zygmunt, a volunteer at a drug addicts rehabilitation center in Hirupo, Johannesburg, says the war against drugs can still be won as long as those that are hooked are willing to change.
It sounds hard, but they really need to go really to the bottom until they realize that they need to change, and then they come, and then they're also willing to push through and get their life back.
And Vilakazi says one day he hopes to have his own rehab center that will be a life-saving home for all those who are now slaves of illicit drugs. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Pop star Demi Lovato indicated in a new song released last month that she relapsed from 6 years of sobriety. On the song Sober, she sings the lyrics, "Mama, I'm so sorry I'm not sober anymore, and Daddy, please forgive me for the drinks spilled on the floor." Well, Tuesday, Lovato was rushed to a Los Angeles hospital after an apparent heroin overdose. A representative for the 25-year-old singer says she is awake and recovering with her family after being hospitalized. The singer was transported from her home in the Hollywood Hills and is now said to be stable. A former Disney Child star, Lovato, has spoken out about her battles with drugs and alcohol over the years, and she's become a role model for young women and men who have faced their own issues. The hashtag PrayForDemi trended on Twitter, with several celebrities posting supportive words. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Zimbabwe's most vulnerable children will be getting some additional help from the United States. On July 16th, the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, announced the launch of Pathways, a five-year, $35 million program that will offer services to 250,000 HIV-affected orphans and vulnerable children, 59,500 households, and 15,000 vulnerable youth. Operating in 9 districts in Zimbabwe with a high HIV burden, Pathways will put communities on a road to self-reliance by building capacity in local institutions. These will then be able to provide a comprehensive set of services that improve the health, nutrition, and psychosocial well-being of HIV-affected and infected children. Funded by the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, through USAID, Pathways will be implemented by Catholic Relief Services in collaboration with key stakeholders, including the Ministry of Labor and Social Welfare, the Ministry of Health and Child Care, the Ministry of Primary and Secondary Education, Child Protection Services, and others. Although much progress has been made in the past decade, HIV remains one of the top health threats facing the people of Zimbabwe. Since 2000, over 1.2 million adults have died from AIDS, leaving 16% of Zimbabwean children without one or both of their parents. The United States, through PEPFAR, supports life-saving treatment for nearly 1 million Zimbabweans living with HIV. For more than 30 years, the American people, through USAID, have contributed over $3 billion in assistance to Zimbabwe. Current projects include initiatives to increase food security, support economic resilience, improve health systems and services, and promote democratic governance. The United States is proud to work with public and private sector partners in Zimbabwe to better protect the health and well-being of Zimbabwe's vulnerable children.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News.